Hi, this is Ray Stevens, and I'm promoting my new album. It's called Here We Go Again, and I'm going to be talking with Rabbi Saul Solomon on the Dave's Gone By show on UNC Radio.
Shalom, shalom, everyone. Good morning here in the neighborhood. This is Rabbi Saul Solomon, the founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And I am very excited and delighted to be talking to a king of music. Two types of music, regular, happy, good country songs, and also novelty songs, classics like Guitarzan and The Streak. He has a new album coming out called Here We Go Again on Player Records, and he recently wrote his memoir called Ray Stevens Nashville. It's lucky he has that title because his name happens to be Ray Stevens, and he's with us on the telephone. Shalom, Ray!
Hey, Rabbi, good to be here.
Good to be here, too. A joy. How are you feeling? You're 76 years old, are you not?
Yes, I am.
How you feeling?
I feel wonderful, thank you.
Good. Good. I mean, you are doing as much now as you were doing 50 years ago. Are you slowing down at all? Do you pace yourself? Or is every day like, I have to do this and this and this and this?
Well, you know, actually I'm doing more than I did years ago because I was lazy back in those days.
I don't think you were recording when you were 16 years old. What do you mean you were lazy?
Well, you know, but still, I'm doing a lot more every day these days than I did back then because, you know, I just didn't understand that you had to work all the time to really get any satisfaction out of life. And, of course, maybe I'm a workaholic, so I don't speak for everybody. But it's great to talk to you. You know, you sound just like Mel Brooks to me. You know that?
Well, you know, all us Jews, we kind of sound and look the same. It's just the way we are. And that's how we feel about the Goyim, I have to admit. Let me ask you, since you have done a couple of gospel albums, including a recent one, how religious / spiritual / Christian are you?
Well, about probably as Christian spiritual as you can get, I guess. I mean, I was brought up in the Baptist church in the South. My mama was a Sunday school teacher, and I went to Sunday school every Sunday, whether I wanted to or not. So you figure it out, you know.
But do you go to church every week still in your life? Or
no, I don't. I must admit, I don't go every Sunday now, but I should. I know I should.
Well, I mean, you're obviously not as Christian as you can get, but you're close. You're getting there. So what speaks to you in gospel music, though?
I love the construction. It's a style of music all unto itself. It's got its own little arrangement, ticks, and things that have been polished down through the years by all the gospel groups. I was brought up listening to gospel quartets.
Oh.
And you know, they're pretty predictable now at my age because I've heard all the licks that they do, and it's just... It's really a wonderful form of music.
Well, speaking of gospel quartets, well, you weren't there, there's that famous Million Dollar Quartet.
Yeah.
With whom you were actually on a session with. Wow, that was the worst grammar ever in the history of the world. But you were on a session with Elvis Presley and our friend of the neighborhood, Charlie McCoy. Tell us about any memories of Elvis.
Oh, he was just super nice when I met him. I didn't hang out with Elvis, but I was on a session with him, and it was a lot of fun. Charlie McCoy and I played trumpets, and we're not trumpet players, but we were so inspired. We sounded pretty good with Elvis, so there you go.
Did you know any of the other, did you ever meet Carl Perkins? Did you ever meet Jerry Lee Lewis?
Oh, sure, yeah. I worked shows with Jerry Lee, and I don't know if I ever worked with Carl, but I knew him. He came by the office a few times. I have an office here on Music Row in Nashville, and he and I hit it off pretty good. He was a sweetheart of a guy.
So off the stage, he wasn't wild and crazy, etc.?
I don't think so, no.
Well, no, I mean, as far as you knew. I mean, when you're talking about in your dealings with him. With
Carl Perkins now, right?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was thinking Jerry Lee Lewis, but no.
Jerry Lee Lewis, no. Jerry Lee, I worked a show with him one time, and we met after the show. And sat down and had a drink, and we didn't say much. He was pretty silent, but he was very cordial. But
He wanted to get home to his 9-year-old wife, basically, was the thing at that point. He was just, you know, killing a little time before then. Just kidding. So who else did you... What about Johnny Cash?
Yeah, I knew Johnny, sure.
And?
And nice guy. Super nice guy. He was every bit as nice as people think he was, I think. I mean, for example, my wife was at the grocery store one day, and she was having trouble at the checkout counter, and Johnny was behind her, and he said, "Ma'am, can I help you?" And he was very helpful. So, you know, he didn't know it was my wife, and I thought that was pretty good.
You know, I have to say, it's still strange for people to think of someone like Johnny Cash or anyone that famous in a supermarket, in a grocery store.
It was a kind of a specialty store. I don't... He may not have gone to a regular grocery store, but this was a gourmet-type store, and I think he was kind of hooked on some of their dishes that they sold there.
Cool. So other encounters with... And we'll talk, of course, about your own career, but it's just exciting, I'm sure, for listeners to hear whom you've met, who you knew more personally and had fun with, and fun anecdotes, other legends of the business. George Jones, perhaps.
Oh, George was a sweetheart. I did a show with him right before he died. We were in South Dakota, Fargo or someplace like that. And I had a great time with George. After the show, we went on his bus and talked for a while. And just a nice man.
So who, and I know you probably don't want to say, but who maybe wasn't so nice that you worked with? And it's, if they're dead, you can say it. If they're living, I can understand why you still want to be whatever. But
I'm not going to say anything bad about anybody.
Wow. I unfortunately have not had a chance to read your memoir about Nashville. Is that also just the niceness, or are you more, you know, up and down in there?
Well, you know, I see no reason for me to be up and down. There are no slurs in there about anybody.
Okay. I'm not saying to be nasty, but if they treated you badly, you kind of, don't you have that thing to get back at them, or are you a turn-the-other-cheek kind of...
No, I did mention a few things, and you can be the judge about how badly I was treated or whatever, but, I'm not totally, I didn't totally whitewash everything, so...
Okay, that's fair. Now one person that people might be particularly interested in is that you worked with Dusty Springfield. Mm-hmm. Was, any thoughts about her?
Yeah, she was very talented. What a great singer. I was hired when I was 22, I think, to move to Nashville from Atlanta to work in the A&R department at Mercury. And the guy running the A&R department here in Nashville was a guy named Shelby Singleton. And he took me to New York with him to record Dusty, and I arranged the session. So that was a lot of fun, you know.
Good.
I was on the Andy Williams show with Dusty, and I got a picture in the book of me and Dusty and Andy singing a song together. So she was nice.
Oh, yeah, and someone that I am sure is nice. As a matter of fact, the producer of this program interviewed her a few months ago, Dolly Parton. You worked with her. Tell us a happy, fun Dolly Parton story.
Dolly Parton moved to town. I had just moved here in 62, and I was working with Fred Foster at Monument Records. Fred owned the label, and Dolly had just been signed, and Fred said, "Here, you're a producer, you go produce Dolly Parton." And so I produced some of her first records. We didn't get a hit, but we had a lot of fun, and she's very talented, and we spent a lot of time in the studio, and like I say, all the musicians loved her. The sessions came off like clockwork because she was so easy to work with.
I expected that. That is wonderful to hear. We're talking, by the way, with Ray Stevens, the legendary Ray Stevens. Now, you, as you said, here you are in the late 1950s into the early 1960s. You have seen a sea change in the way music is created and marketed and promoted. Is it better now over the last 15 years or so with the so-called death of the major labels, or do you miss that, or what?
Yeah, I kind of miss it because it's hard to know where you stand. I mean, it's kind of like punching a marshmallow. You don't know, you don't have any definite idea of what's going on, although in the end it all comes out and you finally know what's going on. But the internet has changed the world, and technology has not only changed the way we record, but the way we market and the way we sell our product. And it's been a rocky road because, you know, in the beginning of the internet, Napster came along and stole everybody's intellectual property and didn't think they needed to pay anybody right. for any of their intellectual work. And so it's changed a little since the beginning, but you know, it's changed. The record business is totally turned around.
But you, on some level, you have also embraced this technology and social media. You have your own YouTube channel. Is that just for promotion? Are you able to make money from YouTube or iTunes or Spotify or any of those places?
You know, not a lot, but you do. They do. They say if you have a video on YouTube and it gets a lot of views, why, they'll sell advertising on the video and they'll cut you in on whatever they charge the people to advertise on the video and send you a check every now and then. But it's really hard to police. There's no way to, you know, really know what's going on.
So your career now, though, is it do you make the lion's share of what you live on from touring, or is it from still record producing or record making, or what?
I think touring is probably the way the artist is expected to get his slice of the pie, so to speak, because songwriters are leaving the business in droves. They can get their songs cut, but there's not enough royalty out there to keep them alive, you know.
Right. So, but I mean, granted, you have had such a career that you can almost do this as a hobby, I assume, at this point.
That's true. And you know, I still do it because I love to do it. I love what I do. And you know, like I say, if you create enough heat, then you can charge a lot for tickets at the show dates.
Oh, well, that's. Have you seen, there's a reality program on one of the networks now where there's a family that runs its own theater in Branson. You have done that. You did that like twice. What was good about it? What was terrible about it?
There wasn't anything terrible about it other than the workload. I mean, Branson was a wonderful thing, and it still is, I guess. I had to sell my theater and leave because I'm just... I can't carry that load anymore, but two shows a day, 6 days a week, for 6 months at a time will really put you in the hospital.
So yeah.
I had a good time, though. It was a lot of fun.
Well, now you're responsible. I mean, as you said, you have an office on Music Row in Nashville, and you have to make new... You like making new music, of course, and you have to tour. What, how do you carve up your day or your week? What percentage is administrative work and having to do press stuff, creative things, traveling, etc.?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm still trying to figure that out. I got a lot of help. I've got a couple of girls and a couple of guys working here at the office with me, so they take a lot of the workload off. But, you know, we got a pretty tight little group here, and we get it done. it's sometimes we're a day late, but we do get it done eventually.
Good. Good. And one thing I'm curious about, a lot of people were making fun. I mean, the reviews have been kind of split on this, but Bob Dylan came out with an album a couple of months ago of all Frank Sinatra covers. What people may not necessarily know is that you yourself did a Frank Sinatra cover album. What inspired you? And this was a couple of years ago. Are you going to re-push that album now that it's the centenary of Sinatra's birth?
You know, I hadn't thought about that, but, you know, I've always been a big fan of Sinatra. What a charismatic guy. And his records were timeless. He had the great band sounds that kind of wrote the book on big band singers. And I wanted to do the... My concept was to do it with a five-piece rock and roll band, you know.
Oh!
It turned out okay, but I think if I ever do anything with a Sinatra idea again, I'll re-record everything, because I've got ideas now that I would incorporate into the recordings that I didn't back when I did this first Sinatra album.
Well, what would be, as you said, the five-piece rock and roll ensemble, but what would you do differently? What would you do now, let's say you wanted to put out a Sinatra album next year?
Well, you know, it's hard to describe, because... I'm a musician, always have been, and I've been in the studios all my life, and I've got some ideas that I really can't explain to anybody other than on the job with the musicians at hand, but it would be a sort of a treatment that was a lot of air in it, so to speak. and the band in the background, that lick would be pristine and it would be by itself and be a lot of air around it. In other words, you got a beat, you got a singer, and the arrangement would be sparse to the core, but it would not be sparse because of a lack of instrumentation. It would be sparse because of the way you used the instruments. And I know that sounds crazy, but that's as close as I can get right now.
Well, no, I mean, it sometimes takes 60 years to travel back to simplicity.
That's right. You know, who was the famous painter that paints the pictures? You say, what is that? And if you go back and see his earlier renditions of that same picture, they look like very Baroque paintings that could be on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. You know, I mean, he goes full bore, and then he brings it back in stages. So that Picasso, I think, is the guy.
Could it be? Yeah, I mean, it's just whittling away, taking away, and leaving only the essential, like the Japanese line painting or something like that.
Absolutely. Now that's my concept of how, if I do another Sinatra thing, that's how I'll do it. I'll pare it back to simplicity. You're right.
Now, when you get a melody in your head, Ray Stevens, do you know instantly, this is a regular song, this is a novelty song, or this is a gospel song?
You mean from the melody? Is that what you said?
Well, in other words, what comes to you first? Is it like you sit at the piano with a guitar and go, you hear something in your head, maybe a melody comes to you, and you're like, oh, that would be good for a funny song or a non-funny song. How do you choose?
Well, you know, I don't write many instrumentals, and so all my songs have words, and I think what indicates to me what type of music that you use and melody that you use is the message in the words. You have to, for instance, the title is usually the hook. That's the thing that people will remember, you know. And
well, you wrote one of the great titles of all time, Everything is Beautiful. Did that just come to you like, you were out on a sunny day and boom, everything was beautiful?
No, I had just been signed to host the Andy Williams Show on NBC television, and I wanted to write a song that could be used for the theme song for that show. It was a summer show. And so I chained myself to the piano at my house and stayed there for 3 days on bread and water, and I finally came up with Everything is Beautiful.
Well, what do you think about that? What do you think about the difference between, say, what the Brill Building writers had to do of clocking in 9 to 5, being forced to work all day and come out with songs, some great, some not, versus being struck by inspiration?
Well, there's there's a lot to be said for either thing. A song is part inspiration and part craft, and the Brill Building people allowed the inspiration to come by sitting there 8 hours a day trying to craft their song. And sometime during the crafting of a song idea that they had, the inspiration would hit. It certainly must have, because they wrote some great songs.
Of course. And with you, I guess, writing for the Andy Williams Show, there were times when you had to punch the clock, as it were.
If you're going to be a songwriter, you have to sit down with a blank piece of paper and a pencil and write. You have to try to write, even if you have no ideas at all. You've got to try. And something will happen. It usually does.
Have you collaborated on many numbers? I'm not talking instrumentation. I'm talking like co-wrote songs much.
Yeah.
How do you like that?
It's okay. It's fine.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, I write with a guy now who I've known since we were teenagers. Buddy Kalb is his name. K-A-L-B. And we kind of write together separately. He'll write something, and I'll take it, and I'll write something and give it back to him, and he'll write something. And, you know, we very rarely sit face-to-face and come up with anything until the final process. And then we get together and finish the song up.
And have you written with this man since you were teenagers? That's amazing.
Well, I haven't written since we were teenagers, but for the last 30 years I have, you know.
Huh. Wow. Now, we have to get to, of course, the song that you are, for better or worse, you are best known for, and was obviously a huge hit, The Streak, great novelty song in the 1970s. Does it, you have to be grateful for the song, for what it's done for your life and career, but do you ever want to tell people, like, I've written hundreds of songs, why that one?
No, I don't think that way. I'm so grateful and flattered that people remember that song. I mean, it was an icon song for the times. It was so many things were going on in our society, but in 1974, that was the biggest thing that happened as far as mass media is concerned.
Well, yes. I mean, it was huge. It was, and it's still a fun number, and Dr. Demento played it all the time, and he still occasionally will, because there's just something about it. It's really, you know, and you have a new novelty, well, several new novelty songs on your new CD, including one called, pardon me, Taylor Swift is Stalking Me. Have you heard from her yet? You have a video about it. Have her people contacted you?
No.
Okay.
I don't know if I've teed her off or what, but so far I've not heard from her.
Okay, just wondering. And the thing about it, and pretty much all of your songs, your novelty songs as far as I know, is they're not mean. They're spoofy, they're fun, they're playful, but you tend not to get mean in your lyrics. Is that a conscious choice?
Yes, because I don't see any future in being mean to anybody.
Well, I mean, sometimes you want to write a song about things that are in the news, current events, and make fun of them, and they'll make your blood boil. I mean, you wrote a song about Osama bin Laden, and when all that was happening, perhaps you'll write a song about ISIS and those crazy lunatics. But you don't feel the need to really get the knife in.
Well, you know, now that you mentioned, there's some politicians that I don't mind talking bad about, you know.
Oh, okay. I think I've just inspired another song for you.
Well, I've got a lot of political songs on YouTube videos, and check them out, and you'll see what I'm talking about. In this album, the album, by the way, is called Here We Go Again.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple of political songs in there. One is about illegal immigration. It's called Come to the USA. And another one is called You Didn't Build That, which is an Obama quote that I don't necessarily agree with. So,
you know, and actually, that's an interesting thought. Your thoughts on the fact that most of media, and media that does comedy, tends to be towards the left wing, tends to be pro-liberal, pro-administration. I get the feeling that you are more along the lines of the right wing, the Republicans, perhaps the NRA, and that sort of. Am I sensing that correctly?
Of course you are, and I'm on the side, you might say, of truth. A lot of the left wing media is just plain not true.
What would be an example?
Oh, God.
No. Come on. You
don't get me started. You know, it's so obvious that just about everything that comes out of their mouths is not true.
And you feel, however, that the right wing, the Fox News, and the, is true? That they are really fair and balanced?
I think so. There are a lot of things that I don't agree with on Fox News, but most of it, I think they're pretty much on the money.
Okay. Wow. Is it tougher to get your comedy heard because you're on that side rather than...
I don't know. I don't worry about that.
Okay.
I'm 76. Fine. If you don't like it, don't play it.
Yeah, that's, I guess, a pretty good attitude. So let me ask you, you also put out a 9-CD encyclopedia a couple of years back. Is that still available? Tell people about that.
Of course it is. It's called the Encyclopedia of Recorded Comedy Music, and I did a lot of research. It took me a couple of years to put this thing together, and I recorded all of what I thought were the most important comedy songs ever recorded, and it goes back all the way to Little Brown Jug, you know.
Huh.
And I'm very proud of it. Like I said, I spent a lot of time, and 108 songs, 9 CDs.
Wow. And what are some other songs on that collection, so people can know? And ones that you really love?
Well, there's the Spike Jones things that were there. Purple People Eater, Please Mr. Custer, I Don't Want to Go. Alley Oop. And then, of course, all of the songs that I have had, Ahab the A-Rab, The Streak, the Mississippi Squirrel Revival.
Right, and Guitarzan and things.
Guitarzan, right.
I mean, yeah, these are great. Now, one of the nice things about your classic novelty songs is that they work as pop music, and they're not just parodies, and they're not just, you throw some kind of melody, but it's really just about the lyrics. They're catchy. And really, really listenable.
Well, thank you.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, I think that's what makes you really stand out from a lot of other people. Not to disparage other people, but people like Alan Sherman, perhaps, or...
I did an Alan Sherman, Hello Mother, Hello Father.
Class, which is a parody song. I mean, he put that to Dance of the Hours. But yeah, it's, so can I ask who are the funny people that you're listening to now? Are there other novelty people that you like?
But you mean that are current?
Yeah.
You know, I don't have time to listen very much. I'm told that Brad Paisley has done some funny things, and I haven't had time to really check it out, but I'm sure he's so successful that they're probably really good. So I'll give you a report after I've had a chance to hear them.
That's fair. And what about songs that you listen to for pleasure, but serious songs? If you have an iPod, what do you listen to, not because you have to keep track of what's happening in Nashville for work purposes, but what do you like to listen to?
I don't have time.
Wow.
I don't have time. I think Tony Bennett's records are, some of them are just timeless. I would enjoy that. Sinatra. I like some of the choral things. There's a big album out, a big box set out, Singers Unlimited, and they do some vocal things that are just wonderful. But of course, nobody knows about them much in the everyday world. But I like stuff like that.
Cool. And you were speaking of not people knowing stuff. You've been vocal about saying that novelty and comedy songs tend to be stigmatized. They have been for decades. On radio and media, it's like they tend to be shunted to the side. And do you hope that is still going to change or is changing thanks to YouTube?
I don't know, but I think people might start to see the light because I was told years ago, we can't play this. This is a fast burn, here today, gone tomorrow. And think about it. You can remember a comedy song a lot easier than you can a straight love song. I'm sorry, it's just true. You know, who could forget the Purple People Eater, for goodness sakes, and things like that.
That was a beautiful romantic song, by the way.
Right.
Well, at least the horn part. But anywho, first of all, I want to thank Ray Stevens so much for being with us in the Daybreak. I want to remind everybody his new album is out. It's called Here We Go Again on Player Records. And you can find out all about all the things he does at RayStevens.com, this Grammy winner, this member of the Nashville Hall of Fame. Last question, and who knows, this may take you a half an hour to answer. You're so busy. What are you working on now?
I'm working on a new album, and I'm putting a set together to shoot a TV pilot. We're going to shoot a show about Nashville. And I'm building a cabaret here, a performance venue here in Nashville.
Oh, how lovely. You mean like a more quiet New York-y cabaret? Is it going to be for country specifically or more standards?
It's going to be for anything. It's going to be seat anywhere from 500 to 1,000 people.
Good Lord. That's one. And also, I should have asked, you have a wife, you have kids. How's your family?
They're wonderful, thank you.
Mazel tov. Well, you, Ray Stevens, have been wonderful to talk to. I thank you so much for joining us. I wish you only further health, success, and many, many more laughs and tunes.
Thank you, Rabbi. It's been great talking to you.
Shalom to you.
Shalom.